Good morning. You're tuned into Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. There's probably no way I'm going to be able to adequately introduce today's guest, Daniel Ellsberg, but I'll try. In my mind, he's the quintessential patriot, having knowingly put his life on the line by exposing lies and hypocrisy in our government through copying and exposing the Pentagon Papers back in the early 1970s. This action by Ellsberg and Anthony Russo precipitated events which concluded in our country's withdrawal from the Vietnam conflict. And Dan hasn't stopped there, but has continued commenting on and occasionally provoking our nation's policymakers to have a conscience pertaining largely to its agreement to curtail the destructive use of nuclear weapons. Author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, published by Viking in 2002, and fascinating reading. Dan has been back and forth to New York, where the United Nations is conducting a month-long review of the 1970 Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. Daniel Ellsberg, it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction.
Yes. Thank you for what you've done for this country. Can I ask you to begin by defining patriotism, which seems to be one of the hottest potatoes being tossed around these days?
Clearly, people have different concepts of it. A lot of them different from mine, and I would say theirs is rooted in only one part of American experience and not the most important part as I see it. I think a lot of people really see patriotism in terms of a kind of unquestioning deference or obedience or awe, even reverence for the president or for the policies of the president, a man who has been elected or almost elected president at the time, and as if he were a monarch. I think those people have a concept of patriotism that's very common in the world and in history through tyrannies and other forms of government, Soviet Union and others, where the state really defines what's right and what the people shall know about it. That almost defines a monarchy, what a ruler can decide what he wants, almost, or she in some cases, and then can decide entirely what the public shall know about that, which I think that latter point gives you essentially a monarch, even if it is an elected monarch. And the kind of patriotism that that I aspired to, or that I felt, was, I think, felt by Tom Paine, who managed to be to find in himself a loyalty to this country that went beyond his loyalty to the emperor, and called even for a separation in that case, but sees this country as a democracy and one in which the public is sovereign, and that to love this country, as I certainly do, is not to be unquestioningly uncritical or even resisting to policies that the government may be following that, in fact, are not in the best interest of this country by far and that go against our Constitution.
Right. What scares you most about this?
Long answer, but in other words,
yeah, no.
People who are, I must say that when it's suggested that I'm not patriotic, I privately take offense at that, but I understand that they have a concept of patriotism that's very different and it is very, very much closer to that of many other countries than it is, I would say, to our traditions.
Right. What frightens you most about this current political setup in this country?
I don't think that the people in this administration really do respect democracy or believe in it very much, in particular in the sense of the protection of minority rights and the rights of free speech. I don't think that many of them really believe in the First Amendment particularly and are even looking for an opportunity in which to restrict it, call it down. In that sense, I think we've got an administration that's very unusual in its reaction to the events of 9/11, which would be staggering to any party or any administration. But are you taping this?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was your, you may want to cut that out. That was my cell phone, which I just put off.
Okay.
In fact, let me take another measure and make sure it's off. Okay.
Yeah, no problem. We'll edit it out.
Okay. I'd say the events of 9/11 would have been a shock and staggering, really, to any administration or any party, and a challenge to devise ways of dealing with a real terrorist threat without losing our liberties and without violating our Constitution. And I think that, by the way, not only can be done, but can be done very much better than the policies we have in motion right now. This administration, I think, saw 9/11 as an opportunity in the first instance to invade Iraq and claim that it had to do with the war on terror, which I think was a hoax from the beginning and still is, a quite tragic one, because I think this was a policy that, whatever its benefits in the eyes of the administration, has cost us lives in the future, has risked lives by increasing the danger of terrorism, by recruiting many, many thousands, I'm sure, of recruits for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. But second, doing along with that, giving very low priority to measures that actually would reduce the risk of terrorism, like protecting our ports and our nuclear power plants and many other things that could be named, which they've been very, very lax on, and instead seeing as an opportunity to enact the Patriot Act, which I suspect was drafted well before 9/11, and to, in general, to mobilize the public for, I'm afraid, a different kind of government in the future. So I see them as a very radical group, extremist, and not representative of Republicans in general. Republicans are rallying behind them because they like having both houses of Congress and they like having a one-party government while they have it. And they're not breaking ranks on the whole, although they just rebuked the president in effect on this filibuster rule.
Yeah, that was a nice surprise I found out
last
night.
By the way, I was just struck reading about that. It underlines, I think, what I just said, that the people close to the president are very angry at what they call centrist Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in these days, who engineered that deal along with centrist Democrats, a centrist Republican is pretty far to the right by the standards of the last 30 or 40 years, and very far, let's say, to the right of Richard Nixon, or his administration. And this, then, is to identify people like Frist and the other leaders in the House is pretty far extreme, and that's what they are. So they are a danger, I think, to the Republic, very simply.
Yeah. The other kind of eerie thing I find with this administration is this kind of shadowy, secretive kind of way of carrying out policies in the middle of the night in Congress, and in this way it kind of reminds me of the Nixon administration. How about you?
Well, that's true. It's hard. People say now that this is the most secretive ever, and if they may be close enough to this one to know, it's hard for me to imagine an administration more secretive than Nixon's. A big difference, of course, now is that they're facing a Republican and a fairly right-wing Republican in terms of its leadership, House and Senate, which was not true of Nixon. And Nixon was in a society that was much more liberal then, including the newspapers, less consolidated. And so Nixon really was following policies that were distinctly more liberal than those of Clinton, for example, and in many respects. So the fact, I don't know what Nixon would be like in this circumstance after the Cold War without the challenge of the Soviet Union in foreign policy, and with a Republican House and Senate, fairly right-wing, I'm not sure I would be saying things very different about the Nixon administration, despite what I said a moment ago, because that was a different historical period. But so this group is unleashed, and there's no question that one aspect of their policy is a great emphasis on secrecy, which has been pretty effective. They've rolled back access of the public to classified and other all government documents, really, on the basis of the Freedom of Information Act. They're openly trying to discard that legislated act and encouraging people to postpone answering requests and to refuse them. And, of course, they're keeping many things determinedly secret, like the people that the Cheney, Vice President Cheney consulted with on the energy bill has not been willing even to, he's fought to the limit, revealing even who was present in those deliberations, let alone what they said and what influence they had, both on his intentions toward Iraq as an oil-producing country and their answer to energy, which included nuclear power and opening up Alaska and various things. How much did industry representatives basically write those recommendations? And for some reason, he very much doesn't want us to know that. And he succeeded. That's the important thing. I'm saying the more you can put behind a wall of secrecy with the government, the less you can really call yourself a republic or a democracy.
Right. And speaking of what we don't know, it was only a short time ago that I realized that they were having this conference at the UN, and I'm not alone on the review of the Non-Proliferation Nuclear Arms Agreement. Is this also being downplayed for some reason? Is there a reason that you can think of, or is it just that the U.S. isn't really participating all that heavily in this review conference? Or
couple things here. One answer that people give when I ask why the media seems to have been so passive and deferential to the president is that there's a lack of a very vocal opposition, and not only the Democrats the minority, which prevents them from leadership positions in the committees and so forth, and they have fewer votes, but they've been so quiet. And people say that the media operate in such a way that they don't, on their own initiative, raise issues on the whole that they find important or that the public might call important. They have to be able to quote a congressperson or a prominent Democrat or something in this case to really form an issue, an opposition. And the Democrats haven't done much. So on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, of course, you don't hear much from either party. In this case, I think the administration is, again, on an extreme in its contempt, really, for agreements of all kinds, international agreements, treaties, anything undertaken by their predecessor, as in North Korea. They very dangerously scrapped a process, an agreement that Clinton had with North Korea that was moving toward a missile test ban and that had kept inspectors in Korea, ensuring that they were not producing plutonium there. He scrapped it mainly, apparently, because it was a Clinton agreement, and he didn't feel bound by it. At the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the U.S. has virtually astounded all the other nations by disclaiming any obligation to carry out undertakings that the Clinton administration actually had signed at the previous review conference about disarmament obligations and moving toward abolition of nuclear weapons. The Bush attitude is just, oh, that was just sort of a thought, a proposal. We don't feel bound at all by that, though. We didn't sign that. And that reflects, as I say, both a very little respect for international negotiations at all or any concept of international law, which they flouted in attacking Iraq, rather. But maybe proposing to do with respect to Iran. So. But specifically, they don't believe in arms control at all. They believe that the U.S. should be testing, which will cause a wave of testing around the world, and new weapons. The U.S. should be developing new weapons. And that, in effect, they think that as the biggest boy on the block here, that we do better without any constraints on us, that it's better for us to have new weapons and even at the price of other countries testing and joining the nuclear club. And that's their point of view, and I'd say it was useless and for the long run.
I'd like to remind listeners that we're speaking today with Daniel Ellsberg about government in general, but the review at the UN, month-long review that's ending in May of the 1970 treaty for non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. So, Dan, have you pondered in what way our government could be brought to honor such treaties as the NPF and Kyoto?
Well, that's a difficult problem. Bush would give you an answer to that, which he'd start by saying that his policies were subject to a referendum, including the invasion of Iraq and the torture at Abu Ghraib, for example, which came out, thanks to leaks, well in time for the election and didn't have any noticeable effect, in part, remember, because neither of those issues was really challenged by the Democrat. Kerry did not raise the issue of torture, and Kerry supported the war in Iraq, rather astoundingly, with the clear impression that he didn't really believe that, but that he felt politically constrained by it. So it wasn't an issue. To call, in fact, from that point of view, to call the election a referendum on the war, which Bush has done explicitly, he said the people have voted on that issue, as if that decided issues of law, international law. Strictly speaking, there's no way to make the Iraq war inconsistent, to make it consistent with the UN Charter, which forbids preventive war and forbids war attacks on other countries except in immediate self-defense or with the authorization of the UN Security Council. And lacking either of those, what we had was what foreign law experts in the UK in particular called a crime of aggression. That was the phrase used by their top legal expert as she resigned over the war just before it. And there wasn't much debate about that in this country, but you'd have to come to the same conclusion. So they, in effect, just ignore international law. What I was starting to say was that you couldn't make that legal even by vote of Congress or by vote of the public. Congress couldn't vote for a war of aggression. That might satisfy the Constitution, but not the UN Charter, which is a signed and ratified treaty to which we're supposedly should be bound.
I'm just wondering when we're going to secede from the UN. I mean, I'm being half cynical about that only.
No, I think he's in effect proclaiming a departure of the UN by saying that we as a superpower will not be bound by the provisions of the UN Charter when it comes to that we signed and ratified, that there were certain kinds of actions, not very many, but involving initiating war on other countries, except in cases of clear imminent self-defense attack on us, or imminent attack, which did not exist in Iraq, or by the UN Security Council. He's saying, in effect, just as North Korea seceded, which it had a right to do, which is not to say it was a good idea for them to do it, but they seceded from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as the treaty permits them to do. I'm not aware, actually, of a provision in the UN Charter that allows people to just secede from its provisions. I think that's a different matter. It makes a kind of international common law, the UN Charter, and in theory you're bound by it. Well, the president says, no, we're not bound by it. We're too big for that. And he promises the American people, and here there was something of a referendum, I think. He promised the American people, in effect, I will not be bound in the actions I take, meaning aggressive actions or violent actions, military actions, by asking permission of anybody. Now, the implication was France is not going to keep us from doing this, let's say, or any particular country. But that wasn't the issue here. The issue was that what we were doing was opposed by the great majority of countries in the Security Council and elsewhere, not just France, and he was ignoring that. So that's very close to saying we're out, guys, the UN Charter. It may bind you, but it certainly doesn't bind us. And to say that, by the way, is to say it isn't much protection on them either. If they're with us, they can ignore it, as Prime Minister Blair did. And if they're not with us, he said they're against us, very threatening, which is a substitution of the rule of the jungle on the theory for the UN Charter, on the theory that we're king of the jungle and that's best for us and ultimately best for everyone else. That seems very, very out of touch with the reality of today's world. This is not a world facing global warming, facing the threat of terrorism, facing nuclear weapons, just as a threat to humanity. This is not a world in which one country, no matter how strong, can really protect itself and all the others without help from anybody. So their concept that they don't need any agreements, as better friend, the treasurer of Sierra Madre, you know, we don't need your stinking agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And he's made the world more dangerous.
Yeah, I couldn't disagree there. Do you notice any kind of common trend if you go back through history? Is there anything that this is akin to? Because one of the things you mentioned in your book, Secrets, about Henry Kissinger is that when you tried to show him the papers, the Pentagon papers, he basically didn't feel like history had any bearing or relevance to what they were doing at that time.
True. Of course, Americans are said to be famous for that. They are famous for that, that they don't pay attention to history, that they regard themselves as, a new experiment, starting the world anew, and that history and their immigrants or the grandchildren of immigrants, and they sort of see history as having no bearing on them. A sad part about that is we have acquired a 200-year history now, and more than 200, and our tendency to forget the past is one thing. When you're forgetting the imperial past, let's say of the British Empire, and leaving it, it's another thing to forget the past of the founding of our Constitution and their principles, which put the declaration of war and the starting of war entirely in the hands of Congress to make it more unlikely and less easy for a king-like president to get us into war. We're forgetting that, and what's the effect? The effect is, I think, we're being drawn back into the pre-revolutionary imperial period, or the history of other people, other empires in the world, after our revolution, which is not something we should imitate. And we're doing that blindly. A sense of history would be very helpful there.
Yeah, especially with the power of nuclear weapons. It's,
yeah. The idea is that supersedes the requirements of the Constitution, that in the nuclear age, it's got to be the president, which is to say, in the nuclear age, you need a king or a tyrant. I think that's wrong. It's plausible. Throughout history, it's been an attractive doctrine to dictators especially, but to other people. I think it's just wrong for this, that the policies we've seen, under not just under Republicans, under both Democrats and Republicans, with respect to nuclear weapons, have not been wise policies. And I like to think that the secrecy and the ignorance of the public about this is a major factor in permitting those policies. I may be wrong. Maybe they would have endorsed what I see as very reckless policies anyway. But I'd like to see that tried out. And no president has been willing to do it. No, to submit his real nuclear policies to the knowledge of the public. I've never been willing to be candid about what a nuclear war would really mean. And again, I fault Democrats as much as Republicans on this, and I would like to see that change.
Does it seem to you that Americans have become more apathetic with regards to government today versus, say, the 60s and 70s?
They're certainly much less active now, and it's not easy for me to say why. I think right now there's a sense of some hopelessness. Last year, there was a real prospect of drawing back from these extreme policies by getting Bush and his team out of office. And we started some time ago as to how one might change this. And I said that Bush, in effect, said, well, you elected me, you got me. And the implication of that would be, I think that's very misleading, as I was saying, people weren't really voting for these extreme policies, and they weren't really debated.
And we're not really sure he was elected. But
he's right in a sense that obviously unelecting him even more than we did the first time, or perhaps this time, but making sure this time that and somebody else gets into the White House than a Bush heir is very, very important. But that's 3 years away. And it's very important, I would say, to move the House out of this one party and Senate out of this one party situation, same party as the president, especially because the Republicans are led by these extremists. It would be much less urgent if you had Republicans were closer to what we've seen over the last 30 years. Just as it would be very different today if Bush's father were in office. I do not believe he would have invaded Iraq. In fact, I'm virtually sure of that. Or would be about to attack Iran, to the extent we are. I would welcome his father back in many respects as a Republican than his son. But it is true, you've got to change that electorally. You've got to change the House or the Senate or both. Even that, though, is a ways away. And when you say people look apathetic, they do. I think part of that is they don't see what to do. And by the way, I don't have much to say on that. I wish I did. But I would be saying impeachment very urgently now in a way that I never have before, certainly since Nixon. But impeachment with the House and Senate in these Republican hands, are these the Republicans that are going to respond to a real invasions of crimes, let's say, by the president. Now, this new step on the filibuster is somewhat hopeful that some Republicans moved away from the congressional leadership on this. I'm not very confident of what that means for the future with Supreme Court justices. But anyway, I'm saying that people look at the situation. They say, if we can't impeach, what can we do? And if we can't, I don't know. If we could get the Democrats to assert their minority role more effectively than they have, that would be something for us to press on. But, of course, the filibuster is a major issue there. And the Republicans are actually willing to change the process of our government, which has allowed the filibuster for years to make sure that decisions don't go against or are obstructed in going against the very strongly felt will of a minority. That has often been used to ends that I wasn't happy with. It was used to obstruct civil rights legislation. But we now see that shoe can be on either foot, and that it's an important aspect in keeping this from being what used to be called a tyranny of the majority, which is something that really could happen and which they're seeing. Interestingly, by the way, I noticed that mentioned that the Republicans who are opposing this filibuster they want an up-and-down vote by the majority. Well, the way the Senate works, and this was a design of our Constitution, the smaller states in terms of population were given the same representation in the Senate. And the effect is that the Republican majority now does not represent a majority of the population. I'm not even talking now about the numbers who actually voted, but in their states. And the effect here is that a number of men and a few women who were from much less populated states and more rural areas are calling themselves, with reason, but they're calling themselves the majority here in a way that's fairly misleading. They don't represent the majority of the population. So the protection of the so-called minority, the Democrats, has to do with reflecting the intentions and desires of what is in fact a much larger proportion of the population.
Okay, seems like a good time to take a break. Why don't we do that? And we'll be back in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Alternative Currents today. I'm Bella Johnson, speaking today with Daniel Ellsberg, author of his latest book, Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. You're listening to this on WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, and 102.9 Bangor, streaming live on the web, weru.org.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.
One of Masters of War from Bob Dylan. Back with Alternative Currents today, talking with Daniel Ellsberg, author of Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. Welcome back. Dan, you say in your book, a thought came into my head in the form of a rule. No one is ever going to tell me again that I have to lie, that I have a duty to lie, that it's all right just because someone's telling me to do it. No one is going to say that and have me believe him or think I have to obey him. I'm not going to listen to that anymore. It no longer has any authority for me. Lying to the public about anything, but above all on issues of life and death, war and peace, was a serious matter. It wasn't something you could shift responsibility for. I wasn't going to do it anymore. It came to me that the same thing applied to violence. No one else was going to tell me ever again that I or anyone else had to kill someone, that I had no choice, that I had a right or a duty to do it, that someone else had decided for me. Are there current day examples you can give of others in places of power who are daring to take the sort of risks you yourself have taken?
You mean, people who would act, let's say, on those same thoughts that I had just before I decided to put up the Pentagon Papers? Well, I'm sure it's very clear from the leaks that we have had that there are many, many people, probably thousands of people inside the government, in CIA, in State Department, even in the military, uniformed military, as opposed to the civilian leaders in the Defense Department, who have long seen that the course we're on in Iraq and elsewhere is disastrous. It's not just something they disagree with, but is leading the U.S. into a catastrophe. And as has happened, I would say, in Iraq, I think we're going to be there in a deadly quagmire, killing and dying for very many years. I think it'll be very hard to get out of it. And people saw that. What you didn't see was them taking really big risks of identifying themselves. You know, it's putting out enough in the way of leaks and documents to convey a warning in time to head off the war or really stop it. And I am glad that we're in some ways getting more leaks, more disclosures without authorization of what's going on and what has been going on than before. That's a good thing. And it's also a disappointing thing that it hasn't had much effect. I do think that part of that is that a lot of these things have been belated and too small in themselves, and that it would be very much worthwhile for somebody to make a disclosure on the scale of what I did, which was thousands of pages of classified documents that really are unassailable and that lay out a picture very clearly and compellingly in a way that a single document or a single piece of information can't do. And to do that, of course, is to expose yourself to a long prison sentence under this administration in particular. My prosecution was the first for such a thing, and there's only been one since, in fact. But this administration, I think, has made it clear in a lot of ways that they would prosecute something like that. So the question is whether someone's willing to face that risk in order to prevent a wrongful war. For example, an attack on Iran that would make things much more dangerous in the Middle East, even than any prospect of Iran's getting nuclear weapons some years from now. That prospect is not nearly as frightening as the likely consequences of attacking Iran right now, either the U.S. or Israel. And people who see that and see that planning, I think, should consider whether they should risk their own well-being and their own careers to enlighten the public about it and maybe head it off. It's unusual to see that. It's very unusual. I'm calling for unusual behavior. And I'm not saying to people, do what I did. I'm saying, do what I wish I'd done in 63 or 64. Don't wait till the bombs are falling. Don't do what I did in the sense of waiting years. Not that I did that consciously. I didn't think until I did it of putting out that information. But nevertheless, I wish that I had seen that opportunity earlier, and that's what I'm trying to put in people's heads right now with this truth-telling project, which is, you can see something about on our website, truthtellingproject.org. But with a number of people who had clearances in the past, and many of whom did put out information, others or wish that they had, and are urging their people who follow them in the government and have similar clearances to consider, let's say, sacrificing their own careers in order to save a lot of lives.
Now, are any of these questions being brought up that you know of during this treaty review? I know you spent a week or so there.
Entirely by countries other than the United States.
Yeah, of course.
The United States has been backpedaling and obstructing on the whole. And in fact, it was largely due to United States pressures that for what they wanted this review to focus on, which was strictly Iran and their violations of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And they did have some. They hadn't disclosed activities, enrichment activities, that they should have disclosed for many years. But they had now accepted inspection on a grade level, were offering to abide very much with inspection. And other countries wanted to rely on that. But the U.S. is so anxious to define that as not only a problem, but the problem to look at, that they didn't want to allow the agenda even to consider the obligations the United States had accepted 5 years ago and 35 years ago when they signed the treaty, which are obligations the U.S. has been violating in this signed and ratified treaty of 1970. We have been violating major provisions that related to us ever since, and in particular, as I say, since in the last 5 years under this administration. So we didn't want any discussion of that. And that produced a kind of stalemate that kept them even from agreeing on an agenda for the first week or so or more of this meeting. And the same thing, I think, has continued then. The U.S. isn't very concerned to get anything out of this meeting. In effect, they're turning their back on the Non-Proliferation Treaty and looking on the kinds of coalitions that got us into Iraq, what he calls coalitions of the willing, which is people who can be, that is, nations who can be subject to our intimidation or who may see things the same way. In most cases in Iraq, it was a question of just following the U.S. lead because the consequences otherwise would be, of following the U.N. Charter, for example, would be bad for them in their relations for the U.N. So it's a coalition of the bribed and deceived and intimidated, but they prefer that to the procedures of the U.N. or the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
So are they just starting to draw any conclusions, or has it just kind of been a bust? Because it's going to be over tomorrow, isn't it?
I have to say that I have not been following it closely enough the last week to know whether they're coming to anything. I'll be happily surprised if anything very significant comes out of this. They haven't expected it, given the way it developed for the first 10 days or so. But I'm not up to the minute on it.
Yeah, and they do these reviews every 5 years, do they?
Yes, if there's a question, if really this one is very disappointing, whether there will ever be another one, really, or the treaty may just fall apart. That's what's at stake here. People simply losing any confidence in the treaty on the grounds that if the U.S. is going to ignore it or totally downplay it, then you can't count on your neighbors following it or your rivals, and so you might as well not take it seriously yourself anymore. That could very well be a reaction of many countries, which would lead to either their leaving the treaty and starting a process of getting nuclear weapons or stopping any inspection, or staying in and maybe even coming to another review conference, but simply ignoring it, which there are many openings for them to do if their heart is not in it.
Dan, I wonder if you'd comment on something. I interviewed a few months ago a ex-Marine, Vietnam Marine, turned Zen monk, Claude Thomas, wrote a really brilliant memoir of Vietnam.
What's his name again?
Claude Thomas. Mm-hmm. And one thing he was talking about was how our culture prepares us for war, how he, as a young man, was prepared for war from early on, just by virtue of how he was treated as a child at home, what he encountered in school, and so on. Do you have a comment about this, how our culture may or may not prepare us for war? It does seem as though we're a warrior society in a way.
Well, I came out, of course, I grew up in part from 10 to 14 during World War II. And there was a challenge, which by Hitler, that in fact was very hard to meet, except if not impossible, at the end, by other than military means. And it's hard to be a total pacifist. I don't feel myself, I've never felt, when I was in the Marines myself or later, that I was an absolute pacifist. It seems to me that the resistance to Hitler, the military resistance, from the British, the Russians, ourselves, was justified and necessary. And so, to that extent, that meant growing up in accepting the military and preparedness as legitimate, at least up to some, to a considerable extent. But that mood, which, as I say, I grew up in, which has affected our society very much, changed our nature of our spending and our activities very much in the direction of military action and preparedness, has been exploited by a succession of leaders, and again, in this case, not only Republicans by any means, to make the public very acquiescent in terms of any kind of military actions, to not press very strongly for rationale before the event, see how they turn out. If they're successful, don't worry about what led us into them, and start worrying, start criticizing only when they're not successful, a stage we're distinctly getting into in Iraq right now. So, yes, since World War II, I would say in particular, we have been essentially much more militarist than we admit to ourselves. Our military spending after the Cold War, of course, continues to be at the level of the Cold War at a time when we don't have any enemies of the military stature of the Soviet Union. We certainly have threats in the world of terrorism, for example, that are serious, but are not appropriately dealt with by military means on the whole, very little. The attacks on Afghanistan could be justified against the Taliban, but the much, much larger invasion of Iraq could not at all be really justified, although the president pretended it could. So given then that the countries that remain that we can describe as unfriendly, like Cuba is usually listed, North Korea, for example, Iran. You can have four or five of those, Syria, and our defense budget is something like 20 times the sum of all our defense budgets. And I believe it's pretty close to equal to all the defense budgets of the world. Certainly it exceeds the 10 or 12 largest competitors, virtually all of whom are allies, like the NATO countries or now Russia and China, which are certainly not at this stage enemies. So it's just a very swollen military part of our society, not only the services but the industries. And that in turn affects many people's employment, and there's, yes, we are militarists to an extent that our leaders were very apprehensive about 200 years ago when they warned against a standing army. I'm not saying you don't have to have a standing army anymore. I am saying the size of ours is a temptation to empire that is not in our interest or anybody else's.
Well, as a society, as a community of a country, all the economic diversion to war seems to be really draining human resources in more ways than one. So it's,
yes, there's a lot of problems in the world that, that it's been clear for a long time we couldn't solve some of these problems with the money we were wasting on military things in this country and others. And the amount of spending in other countries has declined pretty markedly in most other countries since the end of the Cold War, but not this one. And I would say that there are a few problems, global warming or anything else, that would not, famine, poverty, those would be in the world, would be relatively easy, and disease, to deal with a fraction of the resources we waste on yearly on military matters. They can't really be dealt with the amount of money the world and we are wasting on unneeded military arms and personnel and everything else, and R&D, they could be dealt with if we converted that, if we diverted that money to our more genuinely pressing needs. So the defense budget is everybody's problem. My wife has been saying for years in women's groups, trying to urge that that be regarded as a woman's problem, not only as a man's problem, but without much success. It's certainly a societal problem that we haven't faced.
Also, this business of, you mentioned in with the Vietnam War about it not being a winnable war, and you kind of knowing that from the beginning or wondering about it from the beginning. What are we doing in these unwinnable wars? What's the point? I mean, clearly Iraq is not a winnable war in a sense any more than Vietnam was.
Well, I agree with you that in the same sense that it is not winnable. I agree with that. Of course, the president doesn't agree with that. He's saying the opposite. I think Rumsfeld, which Bush has kept on, amazingly, after his great mistakes and failures in prosecuting this war. Rumsfeld said to rousing applause in Iraq, the soldiers, we don't have an exit strategy, we have a victory strategy. Well, what is it? Not what we're doing now, which is what he's implying. Nor would it be a victory strategy if we put another several hundred thousand troops in. We'd be stalemated at a higher level, almost surely. We would not stop the opposition to our presence there. So, how do we get into these things? Well, I think, in fact, that we're led in part by people who really are willing to accept a prospect of indefinite violence, killing and dying by Americans in Vietnam, in order to have the benefits, as they see it, of our permanent bases that they're building there, 14 now, and four super ones, including four super ones, and to be controlling, and if I have a controlling position in that area of the world with the largest oil reserves, to be supporting the desires of Israel, which this administration seems particularly sensitive to, even compared to others, trying to get a regime that is not unfriendly to Israel, and getting the profits of the oil construction, which are, by the way, not getting much profit from oil now, but from reconstruction, yes, a few firms are getting a lot. And if one asked, how could it be that profits for just a few firms, large profits, could be affecting our policy so much, I don't think it's a coincidence that those firms are Halliburton, Bechtel, or something, which these officials are closely connected with. That seems a very cynical or sinister inference. I think it's one that demands very close investigation. It would certainly deserve it, and I'm pretty sure that if you had an opposition House and Senate, a different party from the administration, you'd be getting that investigation now. If it were a Democratic president, if Clinton were doing this, and it was Arkansas firms that were profiting, so clearly I have no doubt that the Republican House or Senate would be investigating this and moving for impeachment. And that's the danger, that's the shortcoming you have of having one party in control of all the branches.
When's the last time one party was this in control? Hasn't this been in our lifetime?
There have been occasions, I think.
Memory fails me. I think there's been...
It fails me there, too. I think there was a period under Eisenhower when that was true, at least briefly. I think you'd pretty much have to go back very far, even to the 19th century, but I'm not sure about that. Mm. Certainly it hasn't been regular.
Do you think it's possible that this country can... I know under the circumstances going on right now, this doesn't seem possible or feasible, but do you think it's possible that this country can be adult with regards to policymaking in the world and set an example for others to follow instead of pulling these power plays and alienating or angering other nations?
Well, it would be nice.
I mean, really, do you think it's possible?
Well, yes. It's certainly clear that when you talk about the alienation and the contempt for the opinions and importance of other countries, this administration is almost unique. I don't want to say that past administrations, whether Johnson's Democratic one or Nixon's Republican one, were wonderful models in the world for anybody. But yes, they do appear more grown up in many respects than this one. Iraq is hard to say that it's worse than Vietnam, hard for me to say, except that it is in a more dangerous area and one that we're less likely to get out of than we were even in Vietnam. But one contrast would be Bush's father's administration, which I didn't vote for. But as I think I said earlier, I'd be very happy to have it back at this point. Certainly in terms of being grown up and having a decent respect and for the roles of other countries and the need for agreement in the world. They seem very mature compared to this one, which does, as you suggest, have not only extreme appearance, but a kind of childish schoolyard bully kind of attitude.
Yeah, I keep hoping, since we're such a young country, that one of these days we're going to grow up, and hoping, too, that this kind of adversity propels people into some kind of participation in government that, you know, kind of wakes us up and away from this apathetic.
Well, the fact that we've come to this implies that age alone doesn't guarantee it, which is true for individuals, too, to a certain extent. I remember a quotation from Andrea Malrose memoirs, which is, growing up is an illusion of the young. And whether even people grow up in all respects is probably a delusion. But certainly when it comes to countries, they can retrograde. They can go back, they can go down as well as up. And that's what's happening right now. My real major concern is what this administration will do in the light of another big terrorist attack, which I can only hope will be postponed, and I would hope can be prevented. I don't think the policies of this administration are likely to prevent that. And when that happens, I think they'll see it as another opportunity, and this time as an opportunity to close down the Bill of Rights, essentially, to sweep it off the board, and to have what comes very close to a kind of military rule with civilians on top. That's a very ominous, and you could say extreme statement I'm making here. I think we're in a crisis. I think we're facing real extreme possibilities right now. That's my belief, and that's what concerns me above all. Not just the way we're moving or the decisions that have been made already at the pace we're going, but at the possibility that with Al-Qaeda almost cooperating with the president in providing occasions for changes in our government, that that opportunity will be seized and we'll be living under something very hard to resist at that point. So I think this is the time for people to learn as much as they can about the situation from the Internet, among other places, and programs like this, and to form their own opinions and to act with some courage and commitment. I would say this is not the time to postpone an act of courage when it comes to truth-telling or to resistance for some other time. I think it could well be too late then. I believe we're in a crisis right now.
Daniel Ellsberg, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We've run out of time, but you've been a real inspiration to many from my generation anyway. I want to really thank you for every contribution that you've made up until this point in your life and wish you well.
Thank you for that, and thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
Spin and spin, and the big wheel turn round and around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn round and around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn round, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn round and around. Merry Christmas, jingle bells. Christ is born and the devil's in hell. Hearts they shrink, pockets swell. Everybody know and nobody tell. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn round, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around and around. Oh, the sins of Caesar's men, cry the pious citizens. Petty thief, the five and tens, and the big wheel, turn around, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around and around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around and around. Blame the angels, blame the fates, blame the Jews or your sister Kate. Teach your children who to hate, and the big wheel turn round, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn around, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn around and around. Turn your back on weeds you've hoed, silly sinful sins you've sowed. Add your straw to the camel's load, pray like hell when the world explode. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn around and around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel turn around and around. Swing your girl, fiddler say, later on the piper pay. Do-si-do, swing and sway, dead will dance on Judgment Day. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around and around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around and around. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn around and around. Little wheel, spin.
Thanks for listening today. Bella Johnson for Alternative Currents. Talk to you next month.
Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn round, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn round, round. Little wheel, spin and spin, big wheel, turn round.